supporters say it's an honest conversation about systemic racism in America. So why do opponents of critical race theory want to ban it from being taught? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at critical race theory and why Florida wants to ban it from being taught in your child's classroom. Let us know your thoughts right now. Get on the phone. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, why ketamine therapy is growing in popularity for the treatment of depression. First, though, here's your COVID update for the day. 1,606 new COVID cases in Florida overnight, 27 new deaths from in-state residents, 734 deaths of non-Florida residents in Florida. The death toll in the state from the virus now stands at 36,501. Go get your vaccine, everyone. Please. This virus is still circulating. Well, this morning, we decided to take a closer look at critical race theory. Maybe you've heard about it lately. Florida's governor and its Board of Education say it shouldn't be taught to kids. In fact, the State Board of Education is going to adopt rules next month that would limit what and how teachers can teach when it comes to both civics and history. These proposals are touted as efforts to avoid indoctrinating students on specific ideologies, and they are part of similar efforts in other states around the country. Now, both Critical Race Theory and the New York Times 1619 Project about the history of slavery in America have gained a lot more attention over the last few years because we're having a national conversation on social justice. So this morning, we're going to have the conversation right here on the show as the Board of Education prepares to meet here in Jacksonville next month and will likely adopt these new rules. Dr. Emily Maiden, assistant professor at UNF, joins us now with more. Dr. Maiden, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And as we talk about critical race theory, what are your questions and comments? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, Dr. Maiden, critical race theory has been around for years. It's an academic theory that examines race and racism and how it influences government practices and policies. It's mainly been taught at the college level. Can you explain to listeners who really aren't familiar with this, how do you define critical race theory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great question. So first and foremost, critical race theory is a critical theory, right? It's right there in the title. Mm-hmm. And that means something quite specific, actually, to be a critical theory. It means that we're using the lens of race and racism to analyze various social, cultural, and political structures. So think of a question like, what can we learn about the U.S. legal system through a racism lens? What can we learn about education, healthcare, political participation? And then, like you said, when it comes to policymaking, that perhaps more important question of how does analyzing these structures through this lens of race and racism help us find ways of improving, in many cases, social services? And so that's what critical race theory is doing at its heart, is it's providing a lens of analysis through which to look at the world and see, you know, the how and why of these various social and political phenomena. And I think it's important to note that it's just one lens, right? Anyone who's mm-hmm. a critical race scholar will tell you, you need multiple lenses of analysis to get a full picture of the world. And critical race scholars in the debate with public schools now, critical race scholars are just asking to be included in that set of lenses.
And so then what is your reaction to this push from the governor and the Board of Education to ban critical race theory? The governor says this is an attempt to indoctrinate students and mm-hmm. that it will teach children to hate themselves and each other.
Yeah, that, you know, it was devastating for me. You know, I'm a political scientist, as you said, and I train my students from the very first class to value critical analysis. And I teach them how to build out their own set of theoretical lenses that they can use to look at the world. So I feel like when you see an effort by not just this governor, Brian Kemp in Georgia, Mitch McConnell has been very vocal about this recently, you know, when you see these attempts to stop students from thinking critically and to actually argue that theoretical analysis is somehow indoctrination or brainwashing, it is devastating. As a teacher, it feels very devastating because you feel like your role is a facilitator of my students' learning. And so I wouldn't ever be trying to tell a student what to think. For me, I feel like the hallmark of a good teacher is that they don't teach you what to think, they teach you how to think, especially in those formative years. And that's all critical race theory is doing, is providing an analysis, a toolkit that you would add to other toolkits in your toolbox, you know, for looking at different historical events, current events, and drawing your own conclusions, right? So it's really upsetting. It's upsetting as an educator to feel like critical thinking skills would be challenged or questioned in the classroom at any level of education.
We'll go to your calls in a moment. We're talking about critical race theory on the show today and how the State Board of Education is moving to ban it from being taught in Florida public schools. 549-2937. And so whether it's critical race theory, Dr. Maiden, or the New York Times 1619 Project, the creator of that, a professor and author and journalist, she was recently denied tenure at the University of North Carolina by its board of trustees, even though she had been recommended for tenure because apparently some conservative members of the board there didn't like her authorship of the 1619 Project, which is also created a ton of discussion. In her work of scholarship, she reframes the history of America not dating from 1776, but from 1619, which is when the first slaves touched U.S. shores. And so both of these theories and works of scholarship are asking Americans to revisit the narrative that we've typically told ourselves about America. So why do you think there's been such an incredible pushback to this revisiting of history?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a big thing at the heart of this is just misunderstanding of what critical race theory is attempting to do, or in the case of the 1619 Project, just whether it's unintentional misunderstanding, or I think in some cases there's a little bit of willful misunderstanding, especially when you have people in positions of power that have the resources available to learn about these theories or these projects and are, you know, in a sense kind of choosing to misunderstand them, I think, to a certain extent. It's a way of wanting to hold on to a specific narrative about American exceptionalism, about the history of our country, the development of our country. And it's kind of like in the very intro courses I ever do in my political science classes, I tell students, like you mentioned a number of quotes from those politicians were saying, you know, they're teaching us to hate America and hate each other. And I always say, one of the first things I say is, you can love a thing and be critical of it at the same time, right? You can love the United States, you can love what it offers, the opportunities it affords, and you can be critical of it. It's not mutually exclusive. And so something like the 1619 Project is meant to be critical of the United States and the history of the United States as we've learned it, but it's also meant to be a celebration of all of these different people and events and innovations throughout history that we maybe haven't learned about because it hasn't been in our traditional narratives. So it's unfortunate that so often this argument is painted as an or. Like, you either have to love the United States or you have to look at it critically through a lens of racism. And that's just not the case with any of these theories or these projects. It's not an or, it's an and, in my opinion.
And let's go to your calls now for Dr. Emily Maiden of UNF. As we talk about critical race theory, the state wants to ban it from being taught in schools. What do you think about that? 549-2937. Eric in Arlington. Hello, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. I just was listening in, and this battle for the American narrative has been going on for quite some time. It was basically accepted that white exceptionalism and American exceptionalism was the reason for our greatness up and until the 1930s or 40s, and then people started to question that, and there's been a sort of a war going on between these two ideas since then. I remember when I was in high school, we had to take a class called Americanism versus Communism. So you can see that this is this battle for the hearts and minds of young people has been going on for quite some time. The problem I think that people have with critical race theory is this. If you say to yourself, well, why is it that the African-American community or brown communities in general are more likely to live shorter lives, are more likely to get killed by the police, are more likely to be impoverished, are more likely to live in areas that are polluted? You can't answer that. The American narrative doesn't answer that question. The only the only answer you can derive from the great American narrative to that question is, well, these people are brown people must be, there must be something wrong with them, because America is a meritocracy. And so it must be their fault. So it must be the brown people's fault that they're in such bad straits. That's not an acceptable answer. It's not an honest answer. It's not a scientific answer. And so, you know, this whole idea of critical race theory is basically using a different method to try to answer these questions, which, you know, if you asked Ron DeSantis, and I wish someone would do this sometime, why do you think it is that African-Americans are more likely to be incarcerated than white people per capita or end up on death row per capita? There's got to be an answer to this question. It's not just because brown people are inferior, which is their answer. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Eric. Okay, so Dr. Maiden, you know, when you look at the data in this country and you look at a wealth of other studies that have been done on all of the things Eric has talked about, it would seem pretty obvious, I think, to most people who look at this stuff that, yes, we do have a problem with institutional and systemic racism in this country. That shouldn't be, I mean, to me, that doesn't seem incredibly controversial. So at the same time, though, what the governor and the Board of Education are saying is that the taxpayers should not be asked to fund teaching kids to hate their country and hate each other. That is extraordinary rhetoric.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, he mentioned the point about the prison system. And that's, you know, that is such a huge issue. And that's absolutely one of the founding issues, you know, legal scholars within critical race theory were working on in the 70s. But yeah, it goes back to what I said of you can love something and be critical of it. So you can love the United States and you can love the opportunities that it affords you in terms of your safety, in terms of policing, all of these things. And you can also be critical of it and say, there are issues that need to be addressed. In my love for this thing, I want to make it even better, right? And so I think people really miss this opportunity to see the and of this, that we can have both and. It's not an or. And that's a real challenge, is breaking through people's desire to just see this as an or. I either have to be critical or I can love it. I can't do both.
James,
and, you know, it's a false dichotomy.
James at the beaches. Hi, James. You're on. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I remarked a while ago that it could be introduced very much like you do when you're introducing sex education to elementary and high school. Do it on a graduated basis. You don't have to overwhelm or shock them. But it does need to be done because, as I say, we are always in the process of having a more perfect union. It wasn't perfect in the past. As long as we learn from the past and we can grow from the past toward the future, then that's the way all of us grow up, not only young people, but a nation. And my hope is that the governor won't just placate those of us who are white because we're anxious. We're nervous when they see that we're more violent than we like to think ourselves as being. Look at the Native Americans and what we've done to them. Look at other minorities, what we've done to them. And it's not a very proud history, but we embarrassed about that. But that's okay. We can be better than that. In fact, we are better than that. I'm hoping our governor will be better than forbidding it. My goodness, that doesn't sound like him. He's better than that.
Thanks, Ed. It does appear that the Board of Education is going to pass rules here in Jacksonville when they meet at FSCJ in a few weeks that would essentially do that. Under his direction, would ban the teaching of these kinds of concepts. Lots of calls. Jane in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa. I just want to say every time I hear someone say we do not need to be teaching the children the truth, my hackles go up a bit because it's not that the children can't handle the truth and the facts. It's that the adults around them don't want to have to deal with the questions that the children ask. And as a lifelong educator, I've seen this happen back in the 60s with sex education, with religion, and so forth. It's just absolutely, to me, anti-democratic ruling to forbid the learning about anything. We might as well be burning books. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. You know, it's interesting that we're having this discussion on the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Dr. Maiden. It mm-hmm. ties into everything we're talking about. And it was children who, it was a child who recorded that video and was a critical witness for the prosecution of that police officer. And so what about that kids can handle these kinds of difficult conversations about our racial history?
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing. You know, the thing that came to mind for me, because this is a conversation you see being played over and over, is how young is too young, right? We can't be presenting this too young to our students. One of the witnesses, a key witness, as you're saying, not only the girl that was a teenager that filmed it, one of the key witnesses that took the stand was a nine-year-old girl, right? A nine-year-old girl that not only had to witness it, but had to relive it for cops, and then lawyers, and then a judge and a jury, right? And so it's like, how young is too young? It's their lived experience, you know? Or, there was just the case, I think it was a couple months ago now, but the preschooler sent home with a threatening letter to her mother that her hair smelled like coconut oil, and the teacher was upset by it, right? And made up lies that the students were mocking her and that she couldn't use coconut oil anymore, right? This is a preschooler that the mother is having to address this of, I can't tend to your hair the way I would like to because your teacher doesn't like the smell of coconut oil. So it's like, how young is too young? There's no such thing. And I like what the caller said about the idea of, it doesn't mean you have to introduce it all at once. You can gradate it in terms of what the students are prepared to learn about, but they're already asking these questions. They're already being exposed to it. And I can tell you from when I get them at the university level, right? Most of the students at University of North Florida, many of them are Jacksonville natives. They're hungry for this. They want this. They openly admit. I often ask them directly, when have you had conversations about race and racism? How have you had them in the classroom? And most of them say, never. Right. And they miss that and they want that in their classroom curriculum earlier than when they get it at university.
Lots of tweets. Here's a few. Please point out, says one listener, that this is an example of the state's disdain for public school teachers. Voucher and charter schools will be exempt from these rules. A tweet from Lynn, the idea that race and racism are social constructs that have been used to inform government policies that unfairly target minorities. That's critical race theory, she says. Roger tweets the show, when we start banning thought, we are moving away from a free society. Josh tweets the show, it's a theory that uses race as its central axis. Many might be made uncomfortable by that, but it's the purpose of education to challenge preconceived notions and foster critical thinking, he says. Ed is in Orange Park. Hi, Ed. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, maybe, I don't know, my mentality is one of a Hispanic immigrant, and maybe we think, they're saying religion, the convert tends to be more religious than the one who was born with the religion. Maybe it's the same way with a naturalized citizen sometimes versus native-born Americans. We know the difference and how to appreciate what we have here with all our imperfections, all the warts that we have. But the reason I wanted to say is that minorities and people of color from all over the world who risk anything to come here and grow up in this supposedly racist, horrible country. But at the same time, we don't see any minorities who are here in the United States leaving, even though they're free to do that anywhere they want to in the world. Perhaps we need to study a little bit more and concentrate and talk about the successes among the minorities of colors, how they managed to be able to get out of the poor neighborhood. By the way, every immigrant come here goes to poor neighborhoods to start because they don't have any money. It's as simple as that. But they managed to grow out of it and get better by obeying the law, studying hard and working hard and passing to their kids the work ethics and strong family unit, which seems to be the major problem among any group who has a problem with being poor and so on. The most successful group in the United States, the most successful, is not white. It's Asian. And I'm not Asian, by the way. I'm Hispanic. Why? Let's find out how they're doing it and imitate it. The simple as that. And thank you so much for taking my call.
All right, Ed. Dr. Maiden, what about Ed's comments?
Yeah, what stuck out to me was, you know, the fact that we were mentioning the 1619 Project and where he's saying, you know, that so often it's naturalized citizens that have that deep appreciation for the both and that I was talking about. I can be critical of and understand what I'm walking into in terms of race relations, in terms of immigration challenges, but I can love this country and appreciate what it has to offer me. There's that both and. And the 1619 Project is doing very much the same thing. The heart of that project, the heartbeat, is the celebration of the innovation, the experiences of enslaved people through the history of the U.S. that is often overlooked, you know, pushed to the side. So not only is it providing a critical analysis of looking at our history through a different lens, but it's meant to be that exact celebration that he's talking about of how did we survive and thrive? How did we build communities? How did we urbanize, right? And so it's that both and again. That's what that project is attempting to do. So rather than say, the 1619 is meant to make us hate America and hate each other, it's meant to provide yet more stories of success. There's storytelling at the heart of it. There's innovation at the heart of it. That's what it's meant to be doing, even while it's providing that critical lens of looking at our history in a different way.
One more call. Matt in Avondale. Hello, Matt.
Hi, good morning. I'm a local teacher at a local community college. And I recall when I was young, when I was in high school, I went to a Catholic school. And one morning over the loudspeaker, the principal said that all of the students at the school were forbidden from seeing a movie named called Priest. It's critical of Catholic Church.
I think I know where this is going.
Go ahead. Yeah, and no one would have known what this movie was or would have gone to see it. And that night, every one of my classmates was at the local movie theater seeing this movie.
Sure.
If you want
Forbidden Fruit, right?
Who thinks this is a good idea, you should know that if you want to make something sexy and you want kids to be curious about something, have an adult tell them they're forbidden from learning about it. I agree with so many of the callers that say this is really akin to something like thought control. But if your goal is to keep children away from this, and I disagree with that, but banning it and saying you're not allowed to learn about it is the last thing you want to do. You've already made it much more attractive to students by banning it. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, that's a pretty astute psychological observation, Matt. Thank you for that. Okay, Dr. Maiden, your final thoughts. As I said, we will cover it when the State Board of Ed meets here in Jacksonville in a few weeks.
Yeah, I think final thoughts here, since we're talking about this and it is so timely that they're going to be, voting on this soon. I think the thing that stuck out to me the most was DeSantis's point. He said civics needs to be taught in a fact-based way, not an ideological way. And that's literally all critical race theory is attempting to do, is provide critical analysis of social facts. So we cannot deny that colonization, slavery, the war on drugs, gerrymandering, voter suppression, these are all social facts in the U.S., and they're intimately connected to the social construct of race. So if we really care about facts, we ought to care about analyzing facts like voter suppression through a host of lenses, and that includes this lens of critical race theory.
Well, I want to thank you for your insights. She's Dr. Emily Maiden at UNF, and so appreciate you being on. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, jazz star Amina Scott as she performs in Jacksonville. But up next.
Patients with underlying depression, if they received ketamine as an anesthetic during some of their surgeries, were noticing reductions in their symptoms of depression.
Why ketamine, especially in this pandemic, is a fast-growing treatment for anxiety, depression, and suicidal thoughts. That's next. Well, in this pandemic, more Americans than ever are struggling with depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, and flare-ups of chronic pain. And veterans struggle with PTSD, plenty of them in our area. Ketamine treatment is becoming an increasingly popular and off-label way of treating this array of mental health problems. In fact, patients who have struggled for years often find rapid relief with microdoses of ketamine. Here in Jacksonville, a new treatment center has opened up. Full disclosure, my daughter has been treated there. And I spoke about it with Kevin Nicholson. He's CEO at Ketamine Wellness Centers. Hi, Kevin. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
You know, in this pandemic with mental health issues just affecting so many families. I'm pleased to talk to you about ketamine treatment. Full disclosure, my daughter, one of our daughters, has been treated at the Ketamine Wellness Center in Jacksonville, which opened recently. For people who don't know much about this, can you explain how ketamine treatment works and how it's been developed as a modality to help people with anxiety and depression and also veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder?
Absolutely. Quick little history on ketamine. Ketamine's been around and FDA approved since 1970. Was originally developed for use as an anesthetic during the Vietnam War. And it's been used as a first-line anesthetic agent in many countries for a long period of time. We still use it in the critical care settings. My background is a registered nurse. I used to work with the medication in the emergency room in a burn unit type setting. So it's got a very strong safety profile. But in its use in mental health, about 15 years ago, maybe a little bit longer because the years seem to go by rather quickly, in an acute hospital setting, they determined that patients with underlying depression, if they received ketamine as an anesthetic during some of their surgeries, were noticing reductions in their symptoms of depression. The National Institute of Mental Health started reviewing the efficacy of ketamine and doing some research on a small scale, and then in other hospital settings and university settings, they still continue to look into ketamine at a low dose sub-anesthetic level to see if it would offset mental health, depression symptoms, anxiety symptoms, and so forth. Because again, it's been so widely used with such a great safety profile when it's used properly in the hands of trained clinicians, different physicians and medical communities started doing their own independent research and treating patients, essentially what they call off-label, which they can legally do, but can administer it to see if they can get better responses in patients who are maybe deemed what they call either treatment resistant with their depression or struggling with medications or traditional therapies that have become less effective.
ineffective.
Right, and we should note ketamine is used not only to treat depression, anxiety, PTSD, suicidal thoughts, but also obsessive compulsive disorder and chronic pain patients too. Now, in this pandemic, both adults and young people have really struggled with depression and anxiety. And as I mentioned, my daughter was one of them. One of the things about ketamine treatment that has really been remarkable with people who are deeply depressed or close to being suicidal is how rapidly they start to feel better when they get a microdose of this medication. And that's something we witnessed in our own home. So can you talk about how ketamine works on the brain and why it has this positive impact in lifting people's depression and suicidal tendencies?
Yeah. And that is one of the reasons a lot of people start to seek alternative therapies other than traditional SSRIs and SNRIs and those medications, because it does take a long time for them to work, and also it does sometimes become ineffective over time. So there's an adjustment in dosing and medication. So there's a lot of manipulation that has to continue. Whereas with ketamine, the medical component of it is essentially the easiest way to understand it is, unlike traditional antidepressants that work on the chemical makeup in the bloodstream, ketamine basically stimulates neuronal activity or neurogenesis in essence. So the brain-derived neurotropic factor, which is an enzyme that helps to stimulate neuronal flow, which is important for mood for patients to start to feel better, it stimulates this activity. So it essentially is helping neurons react together, whereas, again, traditional SSRIs are working on the chemicals. It's not working on the actual physical part of the brain. So because it's stimulating the neurons, that improvement in symptoms can be rather dramatic, mm-hmm. and it can be rather rapid acting.
Yeah. So now, and
you're right.
What would you say to those who, when they think of ketamine, they think of it as it used to be thought of as a club drug, and they don't think that people should be exploring this off-label treatment?
You're right. You're absolutely right. It comes with its stigma. It's been in and out of movies and called cat tranquilizer and animal tranquilizers, and it is still highly used in veterinary medicine because of its limited effect on the respiratory center, so it's a very safe drug for animals and for human beings. What I tell people is that the dosage that we're administering for mental health conditions, all the ones that you listed previously, is essentially 1/1000th the amount that you would be taking if you were going to a rave and using it. It's really a 1/100th the amount that you would receive if you were getting it in a safe anesthetic dose. So the dose is extremely low. When it's done properly and monitored responsibly, it's very safe. And even though there's a slight bit of dissociation, again, as long as the facility that you're going to is equipped and trained with the right personnel, that dissociative feeling can feel kind of like a little dream, like a little spacey. And beyond that, it's really not even close to what you see on the internet and so forth.
I can personally attest I have seen this medication work. And so right. I do recommend it for an appropriately screened patient, which you can do by visiting ketaminewellnesscenters.com. They have recently opened a new treatment center in Mandarin here in Jacksonville. So I want to thank you, Kevin. He's Kevin Nicholson, President and CEO at Ketamine Wellness Centers. And let's keep in touch.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate your time.
Well, it's hard to believe it, but hurricane season is right around the corner. Yeah, as if we need more stress. And I hate to tell you this, but it's expected to be an active storm season, too. With more on tracking the season and some other important news and notes, we're pleased to welcome meteorologist Jeff Huffman of Florida Public Radio and the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Good to talk to you. You do such a great job informing us all through the year and especially during storm season. So let's talk about Storm Summit, getting prepared for the storm season. This is something that WJCT is co-hosting with you guys at Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, well, appreciate that. I don't recall the address on to register for the event, but every year, of course, we hold this event where we especially work with business partners and community leaders to prepare for the season ahead. And regardless of the forecast, Melissa, you know, yes, unfortunately, it appears to be going to be an active year again. We all know that it only takes one storm to really make it an active year for us. So if we saw that with Matthew dating back, I think it was 2015, 2016, we had Irma, and then we had several storms that have really not directly made landfall in Northeast Florida or along the first coast, but significant impacts can occur. So this is the time of year to prepare. We know not everyone can prepare to the same degree ahead of time, whether it be for financial reasons, time, stress. We've got a lot of things we're still balancing as we come out of the pandemic. But there are small things everyone can do now that will make the stress of an impending storm when you're in the cone a lot less significant. So that's what we encourage folks to do, just to consider things you can do now, things that may be more difficult at the last minute when a hurricane is approaching.
Right. Now, this is a free virtual summit. You'll be there, Jeff. Our own lead reporter on environment and climate, Brendan Rivers, is hosting. You can check out his work at our website, adaptflorida.org. And so what, 20 named storms this season? And how do you see climate change driving these more active hurricane seasons?
Well, yeah, there are various forecasts out there for the season ahead. Keep in mind, I think the range that NOAA released was 13 to 20. The number of storms that occur actually in the entire Atlantic Basin has little effect typically on whether or not North Florida, Northeast Florida, Florida in general will be hit. Remember, there were lots of storms last year. I mean, we had record-breaking numbers of landfalls last year, but none of them really officially made landfall in Florida. We had one that came very close, Sally, over Pensacola. As it relates to the number of storms, what the variability that happens from year to year, that's more based on the seasonal or actually sometimes decadal cycle of conditions in the Atlantic Basin. But we have noticed with climate change, significant changes, at least notable and changes in the intensity of storms, sometimes with the motion of storms. They've been slower moving. They've been able to hold more moisture. So there are definitely some impacts of climate change occurring in our hurricane situation. But regardless of that and regardless of the forecast, dating back for as long as records have been kept, Florida has always been and will always be vulnerable to a significant hurricane strike.
Sure. Now, there is a sales tax holiday coming up, starts May 28th, where you can buy items to prepare yourself for storm season. You know, even anything from a raincoat to rubber boots to a generator. How highly do you recommend that we take advantage of this, Jeff?
Highly. I mean, I'm going to take advantage of it myself. I mean, I'm a little different in the fact that whenever there's a hurricane, I'm in the storm center. So we try to plan ahead for our supplies there. But you know, Melissa, one of the things that's most commonly forgotten is the cell phone charger, those battery cell phone chargers. Those are a hot commodity, and sometimes even there's more of a shortage of those than there is gasoline right before a hurricane hit. So those are some things you can think about buying now, the battery chargers for the cell phone, the NOAA weather radios, or at least finding a radio that has the NOAA weather band. I mean, don't forget our public radio station here, WJCT, has taken the time to prepare for hurricane strikes. We have the backup generators. We have the storm center coverage. So we will, of course, be a reliable source of information. But I think one thing we all can't seem to live without is our cell phones. So don't forget about those battery chargers. That's one thing that I forget every year. And then, of course, you know, when a hurricane cone encompasses Florida, all of a sudden Best Buy has run out of them. You know, so you got to keep those things in mind. You know,
such a good tip, you know. And, you know, I have to say, too, Jeff, after everything we've been through over the last year, I think we're all hoping and praying for a quiet storm season. It's like, I don't know how much more we can all take.
Yeah, I agree with you. We had a long period of time, I think 10 years, without a direct hit in Florida. And there was a lot of concern about hurricane apathy or just, we forget what an impact of a hurricane can have on us. Now we have several storms in our recent memory, but let's also remember that every single storm is unique. So even though we may remember what Matthew did to the First Coast and to the St. John's River, what Irma did, we had a couple other sideswipes, if you will. Let's remember that every storm is unique, and we need to prepare and pay attention to the information specific to each storm and not necessarily react based on what we recall from the last one.
Exactly right. And you'll talk about that. There will be a panel discussion on lessons learned, hurricane preparedness, emergency preparedness, even understanding hurricanes and tropical storms. So this is the kind of thing that weather geeks, and there are a lot of them out there, they are going to love this. And I know you hear from folks like that all the time in your job.
Yeah, one of the things I want to point out is, and maybe you, if you attend tomorrow, you'll learn this as well. Remember, there are a lot of people in our state, in our communities, in our counties, in our cities that are working their tails off to prepare us all, right? We've got emergency managers that rehearse and do drills and prepare for this. But there's only so much they can do. It takes a collective effort of our officials and our agencies and our companies and our employers preparing. But we all have a responsibility to do as much as we can. I'm not asking anybody to do more than they can, but to think about what you can do now ahead of the season ahead. It's likely going to be active, which increases our chances of being affected here in Northeast Florida.
So with all of that said, everyone, you need to register for tomorrow's Storm Summit 2021, sponsored by WJCT and the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, with Chief Meteorologist Jeff Huffman, who we're talking to now. Our lead environmental reporter, Brendan Rivers, he'll be moderating. You can check out his work at adaptflorida.org. Special thanks to ServPro Jacksonville South and Arlington, Jacksonville East. They are presenting this Storm Summit. And, you know, by the way, Jeff, we're going to have people on hand from the City of Jack's Emergency Preparedness Division, along with a lot of other subject matter experts who can talk about how to be prepared for storm season. You're going to have an all-star panel for this.
Yeah, I always look forward to this event, Melissa. You know, we all hear the mantra every year about preparing, but every single year we also learn new things. So if you want to kind of get up to date on the very latest and what's the latest things we've learned from recent storms, some maybe tips, especially considering we're coming out of the pandemic, looking forward to, you know, this year's event even more.
Check it out on Eventbrite. Just search Virtual Storm Summit 2021. Register now and attend tomorrow. And by the way, Jeff, let me give a shout out to the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. When all other sources of information go out, public radio always stays on. And you have informed people through many, many storms with a critical state-supported network. So thanks for doing a great job with that.
I appreciate that, Melissa. And remember, if you have to evacuate, you can still catch our coverage in other markets around Florida. So that's, I appreciate you saying that. That's what we're here to do, is to inform and help everyone make the best decisions possible with the resources they have heading into this year's season.
And again, let's hope for a light one. Thanks again, Jeff.
Amen.
Yeah. And in a moment, jazz star Amina Scott and her concert in the city this week. We'll be right back.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at cnshealthcare.com. Jacksonville University's Doctor of Business Administration degree prepares business leaders to solve old problems in new ways. Accredited, flexible, and connected to industry. More info at www.ju.edu/dba.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In the 1 year since George Floyd was killed, states like Washington are taking a new approach to teaching police recruits about racism and policing.
So it's embedded within the curriculum, and hopefully that viewing of it by recruits who are coming through allows it to be seen as something that is not taboo.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Annette Gordon-Reed talks about her new book, part memoir, part history, about Juneteenth, the holiday commemorating the day that enslaved African Americans in Texas were told that slavery had ended. That was 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
How would you change the tax code? The current system rewards wealth and mostly benefits those who are white. Author Dorothy Brown says our tax laws need a fundamental overhaul, one based in racial equity. But how do you set up a tax code that works for all Americans? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, she's a renowned bassist, composer, and band leader. And this Friday, Amina Scott will headline a special jazz concert at JAMS. That's the Jacksonville Art and Music School. She gave me a preview. Take a listen.
Hi, Amina. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So you're going to be playing a show in Jacksonville Friday night at JAMS, Jacksonville Art and Music School. More about that in a moment. First, let's talk about your career as a bassist, a composer, an arranger, and your love of music and jazz. How did you get interested in the genre, and why are you so passionate about it?
Oh, that's such a long answer, but I'm going to try and keep it really short. So I started playing music through my grandmother. She had a piano in her living room, and she was my first teacher. And eventually, I just dabbled in other instruments, which led me to the bass. And growing up in where I'm from in Oakland, California, hip-hop has a really strong presence in the city and in the community. So I was actually really into hip-hop and also rock music. And just by way of learning about different hip-hop groups, especially A Tribe Called Quest, led me to learn about sampling. And, you know, A Tribe Called Quest sampled a bunch of great jazz records and jazz artists. So I ended up just sort of going through that way. And once I started playing bass, my grandmother signed me up to be part of this community jazz band in Oakland.
Hmm.
And that's how I learned about like Freddie Hubbard and Sonny Rollins and Herbie Hancock, because we were playing all their tunes. So for a while, I just knew like the tunes that I was playing, but eventually the deeper I got into my studies, I learned, you know, a lot more stuff after that. So that's sort of the more succinct version of how I got into the music.
And you've become so accomplished. You've played all over the country and overseas, including a quartet you led at the 2019 Jacksonville Jazz Festival. You've played with a lot of amazing jazz artists. Now, you're doing an upright bass, and you've really mastered that instrument. Are there a lot of women that even play that instrument? Is it unusual for you to be fronting with that instrument?
You know, like, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I probably would have said yes, but in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of women who've, like, come on the scene who are not only great players, but amazing band leaders and businesswomen. Of course, everyone knows, like, Esperanza Spalding. When she started to get really popular, that was around the time that I had started really getting into the bass, so the timing was just right, you know, to see someone who looked like me doing what I wanted to do. But now there's a lot of great, especially younger artists, like India Owens, who's actually around my age, Anissa Strings, who's also from the Bay Area, Adee Meyerson, and like I said, of course, Esperanza and Mimi Jones, who's out in New York. So there's a small but mighty group of women who play bass that are, you know, amazing band leaders nowadays.
That's good to hear. So with all of that said, tell us about the concert Friday night, the Jazz Discovery Series featuring you, Amina Scott, at JAMS, the Jacksonville Art and Music School.
Yeah, so I'm a big supporter of JAMS. I did a master class there. I want to say it was 2019. Yeah, in 2019, when I still lived in Tallahassee for a little bit. And I love what they do. And so when John Lumpkin hit me up to come be a part of the series, I immediately said yes, because they do a lot of great things in the community for the youth and for Jacksonville as well. So I believe I'm playing at 7 o'clock, and it's just one set, 7 to 9:30. And you can register if you look up Jazz Discovery. I think you can register on the Eventbrite page that they have. And yeah, I'm really excited about it. I'm bringing Jalen Baker, who's a vibraphonist from Houston, Texas, and also Joshua Bolas, who lives in Jacksonville, and he's going to be playing piano, and John will be playing drums. The set will be mostly original music and original arrangements, too.
It's going to be a great show. Get your tickets now. It's Friday night, the Jazz Discovery Series featuring Amina Scott, 7 p.m. at JAMS, the Jacksonville Art and Music School. Have a great show, Amina. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And to give you a little taste of that show, here's a little of Amina Scott's music for you to enjoy. Thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.